All right, we're back. I like to wander. This whole thing with the microphone has been a bit of an experiment for me. It's been generally a very successful experiment, except in a room like this, I like to wander. I like to look at people. I like to kind of get revved up. Happily, we had a break. Enough people told me during the break, and I thank you, that it's going okay. Enough so that I came back. Kurt, you probably would have shot me if I had said, no, it's not going well enough, I'll just leave now. Interesting. I don't think they do that here anyways. I'm going to come back to the question here in a moment, but see, I was thinking, because... And now he's gone. Is he still here? I know there are various administration and management types here. And honestly, I want you to hit me with it with both barrels. That's where the good content is going to come. Okay? Because if my view disagrees from the way you are managing your units, if you tell me exactly where you disagree, I think that's where the best insights will come. Again, it's the old thing, right? And we're in this setup, and it's the classic setup, right? Where we have the guru at the front looking the part, but the real wisdom is in the crowd. And so it's not going to work at all unless we have that airplay. And that's why we're going to go back to the question. But I want to preface that because the remark was made during the break that business, quite reasonably, has the right and the opportunity to say, we need people to wire alternators. And my immediate response to that was, well, yeah, sure. you're in business of, you're doing car type stuff. I don't know anything about mechanics. So you're in a position to state your need. And I, as a consumer, do the same thing. And that was my response, right? Well, yeah, I'm in the same position, right? I want somebody to deliver me a pizza. Right? And so what's the question here is, what's the difference between business wanting somebody to wire an alternator and me wanting somebody to order a pizza? And now the cynic in me says, well, I can't get a government subsidy for a pizza. But I can get a government subsidy to train people to wire alternators. But that kind of misses the point, too. So I was thinking about that. And so I thought about history, and specifically Canadian history. Way back when, such a long time ago, although not before living memory, it's still a long time ago. We had a thing called the McDonald Commission. The McDonald Commission was struck in the last days of the Pierre Trudeau, John Turner Liberal administration in Canada. Our Liberals are very different from your Liberals, but it doesn't matter. What the McDonald Commission recommended famously one thing, and less famously another. The one thing it famously recommended was free trade with the United States. Tell me if that resonates. And, of course, the Liberal administration in Canada was replaced by a Conservative administration, which actually campaigned on a platform of free trade with the United States. It won two elections in a row. It instituted what was called the Free Trade Agreement, and it also instituted what was called NAFTA, which was North American Free Trade Agreement, which included Mexico. And there was much wheeling and gnashing of teeth in the United States about competition with Mexico. Not so much so with Canada. It was kind of interesting, although disturbing in a certain sense. The other recommendation made by the McDonald Commission was that Canadians should receive a guaranteed income. Now, if you think about it, our country at least, and I'll bet you your country too, is rich enough to do it. We're sitting, Canada anyways, we're sitting on a pile of oil. most of it's in sand, but that's beside the point. Mineral wealth, we've got wheat fields that stretch further than the eye can see. At the time we had fish, less so now. We are the primary trading partner of the United States. Ask any American who the largest trading partner is, they'll say Japan. But in fact, Canada has by far and away more trade with the United States than the United States with anyone else. Auto industry, huge industry in Canada. You'd never know it, but it is. It's one of our major exports. And they become Fords and Chevys and so on. But computers, high-tech, Silicon Valley North, communications. We've launched satellites. We've put people in space. We have a pile of wealth in our country. And naturally, on the planet as a whole, there is a lot of wealth. But, you know, there's a lot of inequity, there's a lot of poverty, there's a lot of hunger and so on. And the introduction of free trade was considered, and I think this was a good argument, the lowering of barriers will increase the economic opportunities for everyone. But it causes an awful lot of disruption in industry. It destroyed our textile industry. You know, we just could not manage. The eastern townships of Quebec had a textile industry, and I know this because my grandfather was in that industry, and he had a little shop, a little textile shop. It was the main house, and then this textile shop, and there were all kinds of sewing machines and that, and he employed a bunch of people, and then that later became their dining room, and that was the end of their textile industry. And so the commission said, you know, in order to get people through the economic turbulence that's inevitable, we need to make sure that nobody, as they say, falls through the cracks. And the way to do that is instead of setting up all kinds of, you know, unemployment insurance agencies and social welfare agencies and pension plans and this plan and that plan and the other plan, which cost more to administer than they actually give out in support, just make sure everybody has a guaranteed income. And then they can retrain. And then they can choose their own careers. And I was thinking about that because, and I actually support that idea because, again, there is the wealth in the world to do it. And I think there is the wealth in the world to provide everybody with a certain amount of you ever have one of those words that won't come out? Subsistence. That's it. I was missing the B. Anyhow. But I thought, thinking about that, what does that do to the state of industry? Or in more practical terms, if you had a guaranteed income, would you work at McDonald's? Wouldn't happen, right? I worked for many years at a 7-Eleven. Do you have 7? I know you're out there in Brisbane, right? If I had it, and I did this while I was at university. I had various other jobs at university as well. The 7-Eleven job was the good job that I held on to. It paid me $5.50 an hour. It was great. But, I mean, if I'd had an income, I wouldn't have worked at 7-Eleven. Now, what does that do to a society when you can no longer, by threat of poverty, force people to work at very low wages? It changes the relationship. And so we come back to the demand or the requirement of a garage that somebody be able to wire an alternator, and that dynamic changes. It now becomes more like ordering a pizza, doesn't it? The garage would like somebody to wire an alternator, but it can't force somebody to do it. So it has to pay enough so that somebody will voluntarily, of their own accord, go out there, learn how to wire an alternator, and then offer their services to that garage. And it does change the dynamics. But in my view, it means that the sorts of things that people do are more and are more reflective of their personal taste and interests, and indeed more reflective of their aptitudes and inclinations and interests And the sort of pay that is paid to people for work is more reflective of the actual work in a society. And again, we overproduce. Hard to believe, you know, you look at the Sudan, you look at Nigeria and all of that, but we overproduce. And we overproduce so much that it's necessary for societies to subsidize the production of grain, subsidize the production of other commodities in order to create enough of a market to sell them. And it seems to me that we've set up a system whereby we produce an awful lot of stuff that we don't need, like McDonald's, like 7-Eleven. And maybe some people need McDonald's and 7-Eleven, but the question is, would they pay what it actually costs to get another otherwise free agent to go in there, flip burgers, and make fries? And the whole concept of fast food changes. You know, I mean, the sort of educational environment that I'm talking about is subversive in that way, right? If you take the concept of access to education seriously, it becomes like a knowledge-based guaranteed minimal income. And the power balance changes, and people acquire their own skills, their own capacities, their own autonomy. And that's the tension at the heart of a lot of this discussion about skills training, industry as a client, and so on. And you can't just sort of cut through that and say, well, you know, industry is a client, therefore they call the tunes, because that presumes that inequality is the way society should be run. And I simply don't agree with that. If you say everybody should have a fair go, love that expression. Never saw that precisely worded like that until I came here. But it really works. If everybody should have a fair go, then you have to live with the implications of that. And if you're not willing to live with the implications because it means that the people who want an alternator wired cannot do it as cheaply as they would like, then you need to be upfront about that as well and say the purpose of our educational system is to make sure that we have the lowest cost possible workforce for our corporate sector. And one or the other. It's consistency. Okay, that's where I wanted to go with that. I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
My question was around aging demographics.
Aging demographics, yeah.
That main tip around the power toward employees. Have you seen that having any effect in Canada?
Yeah, it's already happening. How do you think I'm here? I mean, I spent the 80s unemployed. quite literally. I had a full-time job in 1980, and my next full-time job was in 1995, and the rest of it I spent really poor. And now the demographics are changing, and I'm sort of sitting here, it's time for revenge. And all those people who had all the jobs are now retiring, and depending on people like me, I'm a little bit facetious, but there is no question that is happening, that the demographics are shifting. There was a report in Canada, was it in Canada? Yeah, about Bob Rae, who's a former Ontario Premier, estimated that Ontario will need 7,000 new professors in the very short term. And I'm sort of sitting there thinking, where are they going to get 7,000 new professors? And I realized they're going to have to hire people like me. And then I thought, man, they're in trouble. and this is the case across the board. There is an enormous amount of expertise leaving the workplace, so much so that there has been a movement afoot, one that has been implemented legislatively in some places, to increase or actually eliminate the mandatory retirement age so that all these people who had all those jobs can keep them. More to the point, there's, and people don't talk about this as much, this will be a big problem in the United States. There's an awful lot of money about to be taken out of the economy through things like, you know, all those pension plans and things like that that are pretty well floating the stock market at this point in time are actually about to be paid out as, believe it or not, pensions. This is going to have a huge economic impact. I don't think people have prepared themselves for this yet because a lot of these pension plans are underfunded. Canada's pension plan, a great plan, the way Canada's pension plan works is we collect the money now and we pay it to the people who are old now. And then that continues, right? So that the money being collected at any given time, that's what's being paid out. Which creates a problem when you have a lot of people that need to be paid to and not so many in the workforce. Because and the rates, the deductions for Canada pensions have had to be dramatically increased to match this demographic shift. It's a huge issue. There's been a lot of talk about it, and you know, the talk centers around, well, how do we get that expertise from the people who are retiring to the people who are in the workforce? So let me tell you about my retirement plan. I do have a retirement plan, although I don't have any pensions. They have all these, they have in Canada a registered retirement savings plan or something like that. But the idea of that plan is that you have money to put into it. Well, remember what I told you about my job history. So I don't have really a pension plan. We have a Canada pension plan. It'll pay me like $300 a month. So that'll feed my cat. So I need a retirement plan. My retirement plan is simply to set myself up with internet access and then offer my services online. And my presumption is that somebody will actually pay me to transfer the knowledge and the skills and insights that I've acquired over the years online on a case-by-case basis. So I intend to market my expertise on an on-demand basis online. And I think that there is merit to this sort of idea in general. I think that if we get away a little bit, and I'll talk about this, later on, but if we get away from the idea that education is something that's provided by colleges and universities and that it's structured and that it has courses and things like that, and if we get away from the idea that there's like a one-to-one relation teacher to student and that when you're learning a subject, you learn it from one person, you know, your instructor or whatever, and if you move to the idea that education is about tapping into a network of resources, of connections, of conversations, then you set up, or you can set up, because this doesn't happen by magic, you actually have to do work, a system whereby the expertise that you need, the individuals, the mentoring, the coaching, the insight, and all of that is available online. And it's the people who are later into their careers or even retired who are the best and most natural resource in order to make this happen. And if we made a concerted effort to, I don't want to say convert because that sounds so mechanical, but encourage, induce, entice the people in our society who are retiring or already retired to become the educators of the future, not working within the constraints of an institution, but working almost as free agents, then we have the capacity to transfer in a relatively natural way the expertise that came before to the to the people who are following. And really, I don't see how else we're going to do it. Because there's no way we're going to get these people who are retired, not en masse, up in front of a classroom working 8-hour days. They're retired. I mean, the whole concept is they don't have to work if they don't want to, although in my case that might be different. I was going to say something else, but I think I'll leave it at that. And does that answer or address the question? What's the role of
immigration?
Well, do you want to hear my other theory about free trade? And globalization and the World Trade Organization? It really simply this. Well, you hear it anyways, I guess. Free trade is about the mobility of capital, the mobility of goods and services. And the only thing that remains immobile under that environment is people. And it strikes me as odd and in a certain sense unfair and ripe, absolutely ripe for exploitation when you can keep a people captive and let capital, goods, business, and so on move as it will. So I think anything like the benefits and the promise that are expected from global free trade will come if and only if there is a corresponding mobility of people. Now that's really hard for a country like Canada, and I would expect Australia and certainly the United States to accept. But right now, free trade is a mechanism of shifting wealth. And wealth shifts to where wealth exists. And if the people can't follow the wealth, then the autonomy and the empowerment that greater economic success promised will not be there. So I think, especially in an era of globalization, immigration is going to become of increasing importance. The flip side to that is people don't land on your shores already educated and ready to go. Well, some, you know, under our immigration policy, they sort of do, because, you know, we pick and choose, right? You know, let's look at Nigeria. We'll pick all of the most educated people. Those people can come, and we'll leave everyone else there. There is sort of that selectivity. It's a trade imbalance, right? It's using barriers in order to have Nigeria export people to Canada and Canada to export people to the United States. You know, right now the world's set up, it all flows to the United States. But that will change. I mean, that will change with China and Japan and India. But nonetheless, as long as there are these barriers, there is going to be this inequity. As the barriers loosen, the need for access to educational opportunities for people who are traveling to places where there is more opportunity will increase. Immigration is not an automatic answer by any means to shifting demographics. It's not automatic because I personally don't think we're going to drop those barriers. Because people aren't ready. Well, people aren't ready for an Australia of 50 million people, 30 million of which are immigrants. People aren't ready in Canada, I can say this with more confidence, for a Canada of 60 million people, 30 million of which have just arrived. I can say that for sure. So there won't be the numbers, and those who arrive will need training just the way our young people today need training. Okay, well, that. Pardon? Well, I mean, it's a question of access, right? I mean, I heard about this in Alice Springs, much less hear about it from India. It's a question of access, right? It's a question of bandwidth. I mean, the internet becomes an equalizer if and only if the internet exists, right? If you cannot access the internet and cannot access the affordances, then you don't benefit. And it's more than just that, because we look at the uptake of the internet in places like India, and I have a lot of exchange with the people in India who are in our field, and their big barrier after internet access is things like copyright cost, software cost, stuff like that. When a basic word processing program costs a year's salary, that's a barrier. And so until and unless there is a free or much more free exchange of content and software, things like that, that benefit won't be realized. Although that said, that is a significant reason why I am an advocate for open educational content and open source software, is in order for the benefits of this communication technology to be realized around the world and rather than just in the rich parts. I didn't hear a word of that. Oh yeah, I will eventually get to the talk part. But as long as you guys are okay with this, I'm okay with this. And if you're not okay with this, tell me. Yeah, okay. That is one of the slides from this bit. So when I finally do get to my slides for the second part, which I will, I promise, I'll probably go a lot faster through them than I might have otherwise planned. But here's the story, and this is not just my story. This is the story that's being told by more and more economists around the world, and it's a story that is actually supported in research and surveys. And the story is this. Content, and by that I include not just the typical things like text or music or images, but also things like software. Content is becoming a commodity. What that means is that there is an oversupply. In fact, a tremendous oversupply. So much so that, remember when I was talking about market economics before the break, and I talked about the marketplace being the place to distribute, the best way to distribute goods and resources. Well, and I talked about that being an exception at the edges. One of the edges is dramatic undersupply. And this is the edge most people are familiar with. If you have a commodity that is scarce, then the marketplace, left on its own accord, will dramatically raise the price of that commodity so that the price of that commodity far exceeds the value of that. And we see that anytime a disaster hits, right? And people are selling like a liter of water and $49 in your firstborn, things like that. So, extreme shortage produces what's called a marketplace failure. So does extreme surplus. And the classic example of that occur in the fields of environment and ecology. In Canada, for example, we had an oversupply of fish. So much so that there was no economic incentive to managing fish. So nobody did. And so now we don't have any fish. And that's the argument that a lot of people use. When I talk about free content, I say things like, I advocate for free content, and people come back to me, well, you know, if you don't give people an incentive to produce content, nobody will. Right. Well, that on the face of it is false. And those of you who read my newsletter saw the thing that I linked to from Douglas Rushkoff just yesterday, talking about the amount of content that gets produced for free. And there's a huge pile of content that gets produced for free, and this is not going to stop. It's what I call my butterfly principle. This is not the butterfly effect. That's a completely different theory. Here's the butterfly principle. As I was driving around the Gaspé Peninsula in Quebec, that's where I first noticed this, although I've noticed it applies everywhere, there's all kinds of neat little cottage-style houses, a lot like these, actually. And on the front of these houses, people have put wooden butterflies, usually in sets of three. Boink, boink, boink. They look really nice. I thought about those butterflies, and there's utterly no economic incentive to put butterflies in the front of your house. None. In fact, it costs money. Because you have to buy them. And then you actually have to go out in the cold and in the wind and nail them to the front of your house. So it's hard to put butterflies on the front of the house. But people do it. Now, why do they do it? Because they want nice things in their lives. In this case, they want butterflies to decorate the front of their houses. And if you think, you know, they plant gardens, they don't get paid for that either. And they paint their shutters red, and they have little picket fences, and they don't get paid a dime for any of this. And the same kind of thing happens online, where we have the digital equivalent of butterflies being put on people's houses. Except there's a billion people on the internet. And that's an awful lot of butterflies. And if you're in the business of selling butterflies, the market just fell out, the bottom just fell out of the market for you. I've done some calculations. They're in a paper called Why I Won't Pay Dave Pell $12. And the calculations that I've come up with is that the value of content, and in this I include software, in the transition to a digital economy reduces by a 2x order of magnitude. What that means from a practical perspective is that a course that costs $100 now costs $1. A book that costs $24 now costs $2.40. Is that right? Or is it 24 cents? I can never remember. I know 2x order of magnitude, but I can't do math. At least not in front of an audience. But you get the idea. And we're seeing this. Look at the world of music. The music industry used to hold complete sway, so much so that it could rip off both the customers and the artists and get away with it. Now, McDonald's is giving out digital tunes in order to entice people to buy hamburgers. It's come to that. We may live now in the age of 99-cent songs, or if you go to Walmart online, 49-cent songs. But we're about to live in the age of 1-cent songs. Microsoft is beta testing a program whereby somebody can have access to all the music that they want for $30 a year. Who's going to produce content? And the answer is, of course, you are. And you're going to do it for free. And I'm going to do it for free. And even if you individually don't choose to produce content, somebody you know will. Because we don't need everybody producing content to have a vast oversupply of content. I made the remark not too long ago, if the music industry thought it was in trouble with Napster, wait till it gets a load of Audacity. What is Audacity? That's Audacity up on the screen. I'm right now playing at being a recording artist. Now, I'm giving a talk, and so like my songs are real long, and the beat's kind of so-so, but I think the lyrics are pretty good. Right. But, you know, as people begin to play with software like this, and they will, they can produce their own music. And there are already exchanges of free open source music out there. And the only thing that's keeping the music industry alive at all, aside from a massive advertising and anti-piracy campaign, is the fact that there is not yet a good distribution system for online music. It will happen. And it will happen much in the way I'll describe after lunch. This program, by the way, nice little program. It runs on Linux, it runs on Apple, it runs on Windows, and it costs me nothing. This is free software. This is open source software. I didn't pay a dime to become a recording artist, and the people who want to use my recordings, they don't pay a dime either. Oh, okay. Well, let's do something quick and emergency-like. Thank you. Actually, I'm going to pause this. Okay, we're back to recording again. And if somebody can say, recording time 179 seconds. You know, I'm not getting better here. Oh, man, I really don't want to lose this. Okay, well, I lost a bit of time, but it'll all be on the video, so I'll try to get the video track to add to this. Sorry about that.